Do something a little different this week. And if you're visiting with us, our normal pattern is to have an expository sermon. But this week we're going to have a panel discussion, and it's really an extension of last week's sermon. Steve Zeisler is doing a series kind of comparing two voices, one from Ecclesiastes, the other from the Sermon on the Mount. And two points in particular were made last week. The first is we're all going to serve somebody. We're going to serve God, or in all likelihood, money. Because we're serving God, we're stewards. That's a given. We're all stewards of His creation, of the gospel. The second point that Steve made last week is there's no easy formula for how that actually plays out in our lives. You'll recall he said, you know, Jesus told the rich young ruler, go and sell all that you have, and you will have treasure in heaven. Sell it and give it to the poor. And then Steve contrasted that with the extravagant worship that Mary demonstrated by pouring the very expensive perfume on Jesus' feet. And Judas rebuked Mary, and Jesus rebukes Judas. But wasn't Judas just doing what Jesus had told the rich young ruler to do? Sell stuff and give it to the poor? So there's no easy answers. So we thought it would be helpful if we'd have some of the members here at PBC share their thoughts and their reflections on stewardship. And there's never enough time for something like this. The time, I think you'll see, will go quickly. But we're going to have folks from different stages in their life share. Ray Cookingham, Mike Knowles, and last but not least, Pete and Carissa. So I'd like to invite them up now. And my typical pattern is age before beauty, but we'll vary from that and start with Ray Cookingham. So, Ray, come on up.
Well, good morning. I feel like I've just been set up. We're all given a unique set of time, talent, and material possessions for which we have stewardship responsibilities. We also have unique responsibilities within our own families to provide for others. And therefore, I trust that as each one of us is sharing, that humbly you'll ask the Holy Spirit to lead you through the truth of God's Word and from wise counsel of others as you apply what we share in your own lives. There are over 2,000 verses in the Bible that address attitudes about stewardship responsibilities towards money and wealth. There are a couple of passages that have particularly influenced my thinking about stewardship and giving. The first comes from Deuteronomy 8, when the Lord is giving instructions through Moses to His people about the upcoming prosperity they'll experience after the wilderness. And the Lord warns them not to forget the Lord their God. And these are the words. Beware, lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth, that He may confirm His covenant that He swore to your fathers. Very early on, I realized I would be tempted to think it was my hard work or my good education or the values from which I benefited from my parents growing up that enabled me to get whatever I got, and then realizing that was a great deception, that these words of truth that the Lord gave to His people then apply equally well to Silicon Valley in 2010. That passage addresses some of the intellect or head issues. It reminds me that God has created all that we have. He is committed to provide for us, and He has higher purposes for the resources that He gives us, in this case, to confirm His loving covenant. The second passage is from Paul's second letter to the church at Corinth in chapter 9. And he's addressing that church's giving response to the struggling brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. And these are the words of the Apostle Paul. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Paul continues to emphasize that the minister, their servant, isn't just supplying the needs of those poor in Jerusalem, but is overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. The passage further addresses head issues such as planning and being intentional in our giving, and the important heart issue of not giving under compulsion or reluctantly. Being a cheerful giver is a high bar, but it's a bar that captures the heart of faithful stewardship. I'll share some thoughts from my own 60-plus year journey with the hope that they'll be helpful as we seek to faithfully serve the Lord together. As many of you know, I grew up in northern Montana, grew up in a Christian home. We always had adequate food and clothing, but there was never much money for discretionary spending. That probably reinforced my natural orientation to be generally pretty cautious and prudent when planning for and spending money. The good way to describe that is thrifty. There's some other words that some of my family and others would say, like tight, and there's other words that will describe that. But this applies, our experience applies to many of us, but not all of us, I appreciate. As we began our own family and careers, we found ourselves increasingly able to make some choices as we're blessed with a generally growing level of discretionary income. Fortunately, our children and their families are out of town this weekend, so I won't embarrass them with some of my ancient history about some of those choices we made. They'll seem pretty corny. Examples of how we exercised those choices. The first days of our marriage, and this tells you how long ago it was, there was still a choice between black and white TVs, which were quite inexpensive, and color TVs, which were not so much so. And we had the choice between the cash that we had to buy a black and white TV, or we could have bought a color TV and paid for it with some installment payments. That wouldn't have been a difficult thing to do. We bought the black and white TV. Years later, we made the choice to buy some used company cars rather than take out car loans to buy new cars. That had the added benefit of these were very unappealing cars for our teenage daughters to drive. So that was a side benefit. But an example of how we exercised choices. How much house to buy was an interesting decision when we moved back to the Bay Area after we'd been gone for about 10 years. Since we needed to balance different dreams and different desires between Mary Margaret and myself. The attitude of some of my colleagues at work was expressed, and this is only half jokingly, as if you can sleep at night, you need a bigger mortgage. One of PBC's elders at that time helpfully, and I appreciated this, shared with me how he and his wife had those same discussions and had to compromise on that same issue. So you may not find that you and your spouse are always on the same page. In fact, you may find that you're often on quite different pages. Not everyone is in a position to consider savings, but for those of us who are, it can be a wise and prudent practice to defer spending today for major items tomorrow, like families, higher education, major purchases, or perhaps to sustain living for a period when you may no longer be actively working for pay. I was blessed with the opportunity to spend more time volunteering for Christian service and Christian ministry, more time to serve my family, and not having to continue to work for pay at a certain period in my career. But it also has occurred to me that in many cases, savings isn't just an alternative to spending. That's kind of the good side of it. But it's also an alternative to giving for ministry. That's the other side. The church in which I grew up generally viewed tithing as an Old Testament concept, not explicitly endorsed in the New Testament, but it also regarded 10% as a good guideline percentage of income to give to the church and to missions. Many of you may have had similar backgrounds and experiences. But through the years, I've become convinced that particularly in the circumstances that many of us find in the West, in the United States, in Silicon Valley, we need to be cautious that we don't use the Old Testament concept of the tithe as a ceiling for giving. As an aside, the Old Testament tithe was more in the nature of a tax. in the theocratic system, the theocracy system, and it supported the worship and judicial work of the priests, supported various religious and cultural activities in the life of the community. Scholars don't all concur on exactly what this is, but the total expected giving percentage was more likely in the 25% range as opposed to 10%. Having heard periodic discussions through my life about whether the tithes should be on gross earnings or on net take-home pay, any of you heard that debate? That, I think, highlights the risk of, are we really seeking a ceiling for giving, or are we prepared to focus on the heart motivation for giving and the desire to give cheerfully? In our family, as we balance savings and giving, and as we've entered the season of life, I said, where I'm no longer actively working for pay, I'm regularly challenged to examine my own heart attitude. Am I truly trusting that the Lord has provided these savings and will continue to provide to meet Mary Margaret's and my needs? Or have I developed an attitude that's trusting in the savings and our ability to accumulate and manage it for the remainder of our days on earth? A useful question I think we always need to be aware of. Finally, I'll share just a little bit on where and how we've focused our giving. Our first priority has always been the local church where we've been active. That's to support the preaching and teaching there, the activities that enable us all to serve and minister as the followers of Jesus Christ in our own community. We've also given to ministries that focus on needy and disadvantaged people, both in the U.S., but particularly in developing countries, which may have far fewer resources. The reasons for the wide disparities are complex, and I won't begin to address all of those. But if you look at the income per person in the U.S., it can easily be 30 to 40 times greater than the per person income in some of the countries in which PB families are involved in ministry. Countries such as Kenya or Haiti, or Uganda. Again, that's not to comment on all of the reasons for the disparity, but simply to make an observation about how much more opportunity we may have to share with those who have significantly less. We've also supported missionaries who serve cross-culturally, either with other people groups or who are serving groups that tend to be outside of the primary relationships that most of us have in the church. An example is a minister whose goal is to establish new churches in countries that are dominated by another religion, a religion which is often hostile to Christians and persecutes the Christian church. When we began as a family, we established a pattern of regular giving, both to the local church and to support specific missionaries. That was consistent with our income, which was also pretty regular and predictable. As our own income became somewhat more variable as a result of stock options, for example, those of us with gray hair can still remember when stock options had some value in the valley, and that was an important component of income. But in other things, pay for performance, we modified that practice a bit. I continued to provide regular support to missionaries because it was really obvious about their monthly needs, but became somewhat more sporadic with larger gifts to the church and to other organizations. Frankly, and I haven't reached any final conclusions on this, but the challenges of communicating the big seasonal differences in giving to PBC's general fund, you're all familiar with Eric Soderberg's snowpack analogy, and we've tried in various ways to communicate what that means. And the challenges of communicating the significance of varying levels of general funds has caused me to rethink that pattern of giving a bit, but I, again, don't have any hard and fast answers other than I think we need to be open and flexible depending upon both our own circumstances but also needs of the Lord's work to which we're giving. In summary, each of us lives with unique levels of time and talent and monetary resources. We have a variation in the choices we can make. But each one of us has stewardship responsibilities to our Lord, who is also our creator and our provider. We need to take those stewardship responsibilities very seriously as indicators of where our heart is. The words of our Lord from Matthew 6, which Steve shared last week, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also."
Morning. Let me start with just a couple words about my family by way of background. My wife Dana and I live here in Palo Alto. We live in a home that we moved in back in 1991 when we were first married. We have three kids. Shelby, our oldest, is a freshman in high school. John is in the seventh grade, and our youngest, Matthew, is in the fourth grade. Well, this summer I turned 54, and for many men at my age, we're scheduled at about this point to have a midlife crisis. And for me, that may have been the Audi coupe that I went out and bought last year. Well, over the last 6 years, our family has been increasingly influenced by our involvement with Young Life Africa. Both Dana and I are on the committee for Young Life Africa, and in that regard, we have made a number of family trips to various parts of Africa. We've helped with summer camps. We've spent time with our African leaders. And as we've spent more time there, I've really come to believe what our friend there likes to say, and that is that we Americans actually need Africa more than Africa needs us. And that is, I think, because time spent in a place like Africa, or really any third world culture, starts to drive a different perspective on where we live here. And I think that may be particularly true in Silicon Valley. And I think it was this perspective that, for me, ushered in a different kind of crisis. I'll call it a Christian life crisis, and that may account for why the Audi is up for sale this year. Well, this Christian concept that everything belongs to God is certainly at odds with the materialistic culture that we live in. And I found in my own life that it's one thing to believe this in concept, but it can be more challenging to actually live it. And so this morning, I'd like to share just a little bit about our family's imperfect journey as we've just tried to sort through the practicalities of stewardship. And I'd like to do that by talking about three steps and a couple of lessons. Well, for us, step one was a tithe. And if you start with the premise that everything belongs to God, giving a little bit of that back to God really shouldn't be that difficult. But in fact, it is difficult. It's a big deal. And we naturally tend to cling on to the things that we have, the things that we think are ours. And as the Bible predicts, as we accumulate more stuff, we only tend to cling on that much more. But despite that, our family did manage to start tithing, and I can tell you that we felt very blessed over the years by giving. And for us, we set money aside into an account. We then write checks out of that account for things that we think that God has called us to, things like this church and Young Life Africa. One thing that I found in these years of giving is that our heart seems to follow our money, maybe even more than our money has followed our heart. And so over these years of giving, we've been led to much deeper commitments for those things that I think God has just led us to in the first place. For us, step two was really taking a hard look at where we're spending our money. And so for the first time ever, we sat down at the end of last year. We took all of our 2009 expenses and we laid them out in a spreadsheet. And to be honest, going into this exercise, I thought that we were living fairly frugally. But the spreadsheet told a different story. I had a pretty good idea about the larger numbers, but a lot of our smaller expenses took me a little bit by surprise. Now, some of these, I think, are things that are hard to live without. A lot of it really comes with having three kids. But some of them actually looked a lot more like conspicuous consumption. And there's a lot of cultural tugs, I think, that we have that lead us to consumption. But the distressing thing is, as I thought about it, do our lives really look much different from our neighbors? And aren't we called to be different? And I think it's easy for us to get caught up in this current of materialism. So I ask myself now, do we really need that stainless steel electric juicer? It certainly seemed like a prudent decision as I consulted with the woman at Williams-Sonoma. So, of course, now it's on our counter. Well, as a result of looking at where we have done our spending, we've started to take a much closer look at things and have made a decision, a family decision, to reduce consumption. Reducing consumption, I think, in some ways has an odd feeling of freedom. Less stuff is actually not such a bad thing. In fact, I think it can reduce some of life's complications and distractions. And besides, it feels pretty good to live just slightly counterculturally, and which leads me to step three. Step three really cuts to the heart of what I think is one important element of stewardship, and that is letting go altogether of this false security of money and trusting God. Step three actually takes a fair measure of faith, because money actually does provide a sense of security. And there's a part of us that wants to live independent of God. And so it's really difficult to renounce money as being false. Step three requires a lot more than just discipline. It requires a change of heart, and only God can do that. I recently read, "God comforts the disturbed and disturbs the comfortable." Well, on a world standard, those of us who live in and around Palo Alto tend to live pretty comfortably. And I can tell you that at this stage of our stewardship journey, I'm finding myself just a bit disturbed. Can I really let go of the false security of money? Well, let me close with a quick story. One of our volunteer leaders in Young Life Africa is a young man named Moses. Moses grew up with a father that took two wives, and Moses was one of the children of the second wife, and together he has 15 brothers and sisters. As a child, Moses was cursed in a witchcraft ritual and ultimately was banished from his home. And somehow through all of this, Moses became a follower of Jesus. He moved to Dar es Salaam, and then through a series of connections got linked up as a volunteer leader at Young Life, and was recently at a training that we held in Dar es Salaam. But just before arriving at the training, somebody broke into the room where Moses has his mattress, and they took all of his modest possessions. Well, at the close of training, we asked our leaders to stand up and say a few reflections of their time together. And as Moses summarized, he said in part, "I see myself as a rich person." And as I heard this, I thought, oh God, that I could live like Moses. What a picture of stewardship. Rich with God, despite worldly circumstances.
My name's Pete, and this is my wife, Carissa, and we're going to tag team this section. So most people tend to struggle with money issues either by saving too much. These are the people I like to call the stingy misers. Or they tend to spend too much. These are people I like to call the frivolous gypsies. So most people tend to fall in one of these two categories. And Carissa and I both tend to be the saving type, and so I think we struggle with saving too much. And people like us who are savers also tend to look down on people that are spenders because we're the responsible ones and we're making wise decisions and they're just out spending away and with no consequences. But when we look at our own hearts, we realize that oftentimes the reason we're saving is just as selfish and sinful as the reason other people are spending. Because the reasons that we save are impure sometimes. So for example, we might save because we want security or we want control, or to be honest, we get a saver's high sometimes when we save something. It's like, yes, I saved this money. Some people get a spender's high, and we just get the saver's high. And it's a weird thing, but it's true. So I think it's a good idea to save. I think everyone would agree with that. But it can actually become a god when we start looking to this saving for security or for control Because in reality, God is in the ultimate security, and he's the only one that's really in control. So when I think I can do that by saving, then there's something wrong. If I'm looking to my saving as a refuge or a security or a backup plan just in case God doesn't come through, then at that point it's not a good thing anymore. And so I guess in light of that, in our, I guess, sometimes our struggle with saving becoming an idol, we just wanted to share a few areas in our lives where we felt like God was leading us to spend money when we'd actually rather save it. So these are a few things. The first one has to do with tithing. It's been alluded to before, but because saving can be our idol, and the opposite of saving is giving money away, which is exactly what tithing is, sometimes it can be difficult. I think ideally we'd like to identify some baseline amount and that's kind of comfortable for us, identify that and set that aside and then just save the rest. And in that case, I don't think it's a pure motive for us. So what we've actually done is we've, at each stage of life, identify what would be that comfortable amount, and then we've intentionally set aside a little bit more so that we're a little uncomfortable. And that's been actually good. It takes away the security, and you're kind of reminded that I'm not set aside my money, I'm setting aside God's money. And then it's really a blessing to be able to give that once you've done that. And so that's been kind of cool. The second example relates to the reason that we're here in California. So early on in our relationship, we felt like God was calling us to at some point live and serve him in another country. And the idea was that I would get a professorship somewhere at another school, and we'd both serve as ambassadors and proclaim the gospel in that way. And we, after undergrad, after I had applied for grad schools, we found out that name recognition for graduate school actually carried a significant amount of weight as far as getting jobs in other countries. And so Stanford has a good name. Most people have heard of that in other countries. So I was like, sweet, that's a good deal. And I got accepted. The problem is there was no money or anything for me as I got accepted. At the same time, I got accepted to another school that had a great engineering department, and they offered to pay for tuition and give me a stipend the day I stepped on campus. And so this was actually a really, really difficult decision because in the second case, I had security and control and kind of a guaranteed financial stability for the whole time. And then coming here, there was no guarantee, and we had to pay a bunch of money. And there's no guarantee that I would ever get paid through the whole time I've been here. But because of where we felt God leading us to go, we took a step of faith and decided to spend in this case when we'd rather save. And after the first year of paying, I actually did get funding, which is awesome. But almost every quarter since then has been a big question mark, whether am I going to get paid this quarter or am I going to have to pay a big chunk of money. So I think it's God's way of taking this idol out from under us and having us follow this. And we're very glad that we came here, though, to meet all of you people. It's been nice. Carissa's probably met all of you. I haven't actually met all of you. So these are two examples of where we felt God just kind of poking us to spend a little when we'd rather save. And I'll let Carissa give a few more examples.
She's trying to take my notes away. So I'm going to share kind of the third example of how this is kind of, for me more than Pete, how God's been working in my heart in the past few months even, for how I make kind of the small financial decisions. And I'm responsible in our household for the groceries and the clothing and kind of those things. So Pete hates shopping with a passion, so I buy his clothes. So if you ever don't like his clothes, it's my fault. Don't blame him. So I think he's dressed pretty well this morning. But so anyway, I was raised in a household where we were missionaries, and so we really didn't have that much to live on. And so frugality was like not only a necessity, but also really highly valued because it was like a direct correlation between how much we spent and how much went for ministry. I grew up with this idea that you never buy something for more when you could get it for less. And so the idea of paying more for something that I could get cheaper is kind of foreign to me. And like P Pete said, I kind of, you can get that saver's high from getting a really good deal on something. And so it just seems kind of unnatural and wrong to not shoot for that. But in the past few years, and even the past year more, I've been confronted over and over with more and more information about how many global companies that all of us purchase from really just care about their profit, and that means that they're willing to step over and crush any kinds of people, animals, environment, whatever that gets in the way of that bottom line. And that's, you know, that's capitalism, that's how it's supposed to work, but at the same time, it goes too far. And that means, just a few examples of what that means that most of the meat that we eat in the U.S. is not only comes from animals that are, like, fed all kinds of chemicals and made to live in horrible conditions, but also the workers who are taking care of those animals are often being taken advantage of, treated unfairly, paid unfairly, and they're getting sick from the working conditions they're living in. It means most of our coffee and chocolate is farmed under forced labor conditions, and most of our clothes are, shockingly, if you look at how many of our clothes are made by women and children working in sweatshops around the world who are routinely abused and raped and have to work in terrible conditions, all because we demand cheaper clothes in the United States. So anyway, I don't say all that to kind of put a guilt trip on you, but just to say that God's been bringing this information to me over and over in the past year, and I kind of, even the missions conference we had here at PBC last fall was all about justice and slavery, and it was kind of one more step in my process. But I kept putting off making any changes in the way that I shot, and the excuse that I used was that if I could save more on the small things, then I could give more away, and we could also save more for our future ministry. So it was a good thing, and it was just kind of a balancing of what's more important, and I was making the right decision. But a couple of months ago, I kind of read another article about this whole topic, and I realized as I examined my heart that my real motives for shopping the way that I shopped were not as selfless as I thought. Really, I was afraid of spending more on clothes and groceries. And I was afraid of the fact that if I decided to shop more ethically, that would mean that I would have to buy less to afford it because, as we all know, these kinds of products tend to cost a lot more. I realized I would have to take a lot more time to research the companies and to drive farther to go to a certain store rather than the one that's half a block from my house. I just didn't want to do that, so I kept putting it off and using my righteous-sounding excuse. But I decided at this point that since if those were really my motives, that wasn't a good reason, and it was time to make some changes. And if this is really God's money that I'm spending, if everything that we own is coming directly from God, then He cares where it's going and what kind of companies it's going to support. And He cares most of all that I live honorably before Him and with a clean conscience and trust Him with whatever the results of that are. So in this case, that meant being willing to step out of my comfort zone and spend a little more and trust Him to provide for us financially. And also that He would possibly call me to make some personal sacrifices with how many clothes and how much food I buy and how much time I put into those purchases. And it's the same kind of sacrifices that we all hear about making to be good stewards of the environmental resources we have, of, you know, trying to recycle and riding our bikes to work and wasting less, throwing things away less, all that. It's kind of the same idea. But I do want to just temper this by saying that for me, this I don't want this to become a legalistic thing for me. And I've kind of been praying through that as I make these changes. Relationships and ministry always come first. And so even though I'm choosing to buy more grass-fed and organic and fair trade and all that, I know that that might not always be a possibility. It's really easy to get that stuff around here. It's not easy in other places in the world, and in the country even. And I need to be okay with that, and I need to not stress about it. And I definitely don't want to turn this into a cause that I crusade for, because the cause that I crusade for is the gospel. It's not whether people are buying organic or not. But I do believe firmly that we as humans were designed to live within boundaries and that we don't just have the right to consume as much as we want to or to live as expansively as we do in America. So for me, that's meant being willing to spend a little more on the small things and trust God with the results. So thanks.
Great. Excuse me. Well, thanks to all the panelists. We have just a little bit more time. And as I said at the start, there's never enough time for what we'd like to do here. This is the start of the conversation. We haven't obviously addressed every perspective, but it's clear that each person up here has been very thoughtful. We did want to, some of you submitted questions last week, and we wanted to sort of present those to our brothers and our sister here and let them respond. And I'll change the order up a little bit from the first service. One of the questions was simply, how do you respond to public panhandling? Maybe Pete and Carissa, I don't know if you want to take a...
wanted to share a practical example that somebody brought to me after last service. They said that when somebody comes up to them on the street and asks for money, he'll say, well, what do you need? And then they'll usually say what they need, bus pass, some food, clothes, whatever. And then usually it's in a city, and he'll take the time to go, okay, you need some gloves, let's go over to the store and buy some right now. And if the person actually needed gloves, they'll usually be grateful and go for it. And if they didn't really need gloves, they just wanted money to go buy a beer or something, they'll say, oh, that's okay, don't worry about it. I thought that was pretty cool. It involves taking a little more time to go with this person and do that thing. And it takes out the element of just giving money away without knowing where it goes. So I thought that was good, and it shows that you care. You're going to walk over and have a conversation with them as well.
Great, thanks. Anyone else? Okay, next question. And I think this one kind of starts to get at not just money, but our time. We're obviously stewards of time as well. Says, I am a stay-at-home mom, comfortable and thankful for that. However, it seems that God has gifted me with special skills in math, science, and business that could be exercised more fully in a workplace setting. Am I being a good steward of my talents by focusing my time at home with my children? Ray, can I start with you on that one?
Sure. I think it's important we not fall into the trap of thinking only those things we do and get paid for are worthwhile and are important. So I might encourage her to see if within her neighborhood or among her friends, are there other folks who would really benefit from some of the talents that she has, and maybe she can use time that would be very constrained if she were trying to work for money, but might have a lot more freedom to share that time with folks who could benefit from some of the talents and skills that she has. And that's just as important as working for money.
Great. Mike, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I can relate to this question because we faced that exact question. It was about 10 years ago. Dana is well-equipped for the workforce with a graduate degree and work experience, and had a Silicon Valley job when we started to have children. And so we talked this through, and ultimately Dana did step out of the workforce, but I guess the point I'd make is one, I think this is a question that you really have to wrestle with, because I don't think there is an appropriate answer. Everyone's circumstances are different, and part of what enabled us to do that was my salary did cover our basic needs, and so we had that luxury, and that's not always the case. But the other thing we thought about was seasons, and I think in some cases there are seasons of your life, and I know that... one of the things that we felt was really important was since Dana could spend time with the kids, that we actually took advantage of that and do it for that season. And then as the next season arises, we may or may not reconsider that.
Great, thanks. Anything? No? Probably the last one we have time for, and this would be for anyone to respond, so jump in. Besides individual stewardship, what can we as a church community do to live a lifestyle that counters the consumerism and materialism that is so rampant in our culture? Who'd like to go first on that one?
I think in some ways the difficulty is the same as we face as individuals, and that is we tend making the right choice often comes down to balancing sort of our natural inclination to maybe steer more towards materialism versus really consulting with God on this. And so as I've thought about this question a bit, I think that probably the best thing that we can do as a church is to pray for those who are trusted with that decision, that they will hear God's voice and play it out in a way that's honoring of Him rather than the things that we can be drawn to naturally do on our own.
Great. Anyone else?
Well, besides being aware of how pervasive consumerism is in our culture, and I think awareness is one of the first steps of ensuring that we're not just following along with that. But I think another is to present as many of the opportunities that our missionaries and families in our congregation are using to share, to both live counterculturally, but particularly to share with folks around the world whose living situations may be very different than ours, and for us all to uphold them in prayer, to encourage them, support them, and to see those as models that we might emulate ourselves.
And I'm not sure if this is talking about church community as a church. I think that's what you guys were addressing more. But a big part is how we live as individuals within that community. And something my dad used to share when talking about finances is that a lot of Christians think in terms of when they're purchasing a house or purchasing a juicer, whatever purchases they make, financial decisions they make, they think, what's the wisest thing and what can I afford? And I'm going to try not to go into debt, and what's like a wise financial decision. But the alternative to that is to think, what is going to serve God the most? And that might be a big house where you entertain a lot or have people stay, or some way that you're using that house for ministry. Or it might be you can afford a huge house, but you choose to live in a two-bedroom house so that you have less house to take care of, or you choose to rent so you don't even have to deal with all the complications that come with owning a house. So it could look different for different people, and it's not necessarily tied to how much you can afford. What your income is necessarily means this is your lifestyle. It's everything is what's going to serve God the most in my life.
So. Great. Well, I wish we had more time. Why don't we give our panel a warm round of applause? And let me dismiss the panel and ask the ushers to come forward now. We're going to receive the morning offering. And